Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway and we're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 2nd of June. Our main stories. At least five policemen are shot in another night of violence in the US as President Trump threatens to send in the troops. Restaurants across most of France open as more coronavirus restrictions are relaxed. And how far apart should we be to avoid COVID-19? Also in the podcast, as gyms and bars reopen in parts of Germany, are things moving too fast?
Yeah, ich bin sehr skeptisch.
I'm very skeptical. It's like tipping over a sack of potatoes.
And one of Nigeria's biggest reggae stars, Majek Fashek, has died. We look back at his career. At least five policemen shot and claims of heavy tactics being deployed against peaceful protesters. The unrest following the killing of George Floyd shows no sign of ending. President Trump has threatened to send in the military if state governors don't clamp down harder. But he was accused by his presidential rival Joe Biden of using tear gas on peaceful protesters in order to get a photo opportunity. From outside the White House, our correspondent Aleem Makbul has this report.
What happened in this city last night was a total disgrace. As we speak, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and law enforcement officers.
And he did. In the warm early evening, the streets of the American capital were filled with huge numbers of security forces that dispersed what had all day been peaceful protesters in the shadow of the White House. Sound bombs and rubber bullets were fired and tear gas was hissing all around. The officers repeatedly charged the demonstrators. We saw one young protester who'd come out to mark a week since George Floyd's brutal death, clearly shell-shocked.
I feel like I'm not even feeling one-eighth of what black people feel every single day, and I'm terrified.
You are the threat!
There was a new chant directed at the president, but he was planning a photo op. The protests of recent days happened close to the historic St. John's Church beside the White House. It was from here that security forces most heavy-handedly removed protesters. After it was cleared and secured, the president suddenly appeared at the church with the cameras, presumably to show he wasn't afraid to leave the White House. There he posed awkwardly with a Bible.
Let me be clear. The president just used a Bible and one of the churches of my diocese without permission as a backdrop for a message antithetical to the teachings of Jesus and everything that our churches stand for.
The Right Reverend Marion Budd, the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, quickly told CNN how angry she was.
He sanctioned the use of tear gas by police officers in riot gear to clear the church guard. I am outraged.
And leading Democrats have called it shameful to call out the American military to confront American citizens. It did stop the widespread chaos there's been in Washington in recent nights and has been popular with many of the president's supporters, but it infringed on freedoms of speech and expression and, of course, didn't deal with the underlying issue at hand. One protester told me this was just the beginning.
We've been Martin Luther King for ages, for generations, generations on end. It's time for Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey. Like, no justice, no peace. Like, that's not just a mantra anymore. That's about to be a way of life. It has to be. It has to be.
That report from Washington by Aleem Mukbul. It was the seventh night of unrest following the killing of George Floyd. Most protests were non-violent, but many people ignored curfew orders. There are reports that two people died in Chicago, while several police officers were wounded elsewhere. For the latest from New York, I spoke to our correspondent, Neda Taufik.
Despite the curfew that went in place in New York from 11 p.m., we saw even some looting and vandalism before that. Protesters, for the most part, all day long protested peacefully, but there were a couple of incidents. You had people going through Union Square all the way up to Herald Square, hitting the iconic department store Macy's, pulling off the wood panels that were protecting the windows there with the displays, breaking through the windows and looting. And it really seemed to be indiscriminate. Lots of different stores in the area, all the way up to Fifth Avenue, Rockefeller Center, all targeted. And officials are saying that it was by a small organized group. It does seem they came with cars. They came ready to loot. And we did see a few officers targeted. In the Bronx in particular, you had a car, a hit and run situation where an officer was hit, launching him into the air. He is now in hospital. And so certainly, you have this concern in New York that there are two different situations going on. You have those who are trying to really remember and protest peacefully, and others who are trying to take advantage of the situation when night goes down. And so what we've heard from the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, is that they are going to move the curfew till 8 p.m. tonight, again asking people to really respect that curfew so they can distinguish these two groups.
Yeah, I'm seeing reports of police injured elsewhere in the U.S. So are we seeing that the character of the situation change now?
Listen, I think what we're seeing is a nation deeply in pain, still trying to heal from decades-long issues of racial injustice. And when you have people, especially during the coronavirus, New York has been the epicenter of the coronavirus, we've seen a lot of these long-standing issues really come to the forefront, whether it be inequality in health and wealth. And people have been demanding to be heard, demanding change. And many of the protesters, when you speak to them, say you have to be not necessarily violent but disruptive in order to be heard, that their peaceful protests over the years have not accomplished anything. And so they're trying to get their point across. How long they think it's necessary to do that, that's what's going to be interesting to see.
Neda Taufik in New York. For the first time in months, people in France have been able to return to cafes as more coronavirus restrictions are eased. Restaurants are also welcoming back diners. Christina Montenegro runs a cafe in the center of Paris.
I was so happy to see the terrace today. And, it's, you know, people are so happy, so thankful also for each coffee. And we're very glad of that, too, because it's like a social matter, too.
But some control measures do remain in the capital, as we heard from our correspondent there, Hugh Schofield.
In Paris, bars, cafes, restaurants can open, but only on the outside. Only terraces can open because it's been calculated that there is still a lingering risk of infection here in Paris. It has to remain under a higher degree of surveillance. Here in the 6th arrondissement, Café de la Mairie, it's just opened after 2 months. We've been speaking to the owner. He's absolutely delighted to be coming out of this long period of misery. It does mean that certain cafes and restaurants that don't have terraces are kind of left out of all of this, but the city authorities have extended a right to them for the next few weeks at least to create makeshift terraces in parking spaces next to shops, next to them and so on, so that they too can benefit from the possibility of opening outside. That's Paris. Across the country, it's back to normal, more or less. Cafes, bars, restaurants can open as per usual, as can gyms, as can theatres, as can museums. In cafes and restaurants, there are rules, though. A metre distance between tables, for example. Staff have to wear masks. And if you're having a drink in a bar, you've got to sit down. You can't stand at the bar. But it's a big, big step. And in advance of the summer, of course, it's giving a certain optimism to people that the French will have a tourist season, a holiday season, something approaching like normal.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Over in Germany, gyms and bars are reopening in several towns and cities, but some people are worried that too many control measures are being lifted too soon. Jenny Hill sent this report from the city of Düsseldorf.
Germany's cautious approach, relaxing now. On a sunny day, the banks of the River Rhine are crowded with sunbathers. Cyclists glide around strolling couples, and under a pavement table, a dog opens a lazy eye as a waiter brings wine and beer to cheerful drinkers.
Angela Merkel continues to warn repeatedly that this country is still in the early stages of the pandemic. On a day like this, it's hard to believe it. Germany has brought its outbreak under control, but there is now an intense public debate about what happens next.
Small but voluble, there have been street protests in recent weeks. A minority, political extremists, conspiracy theorists, demanding Angela Merkel lift restrictions. That's really in the power of Germany's regional leaders. But many of the 16 state prime ministers have also demanded a swift relaxation policy. Armin Laschet, who leads North Rhine-Westphalia, was one of the loudest voices. He's also a leading candidate to replace Mrs. Merkel when she steps down next year.
Es gibt das gesundheitliche Problem der Pandemie.
We have the health problem of the pandemic, but there's other damage. Children from disadvantaged backgrounds who couldn't go to school. Sick people who didn't get treatment because the hospitals were reserved for COVID. People in care homes got lonely. This is damage too, and it's claimed lives.
Auch das sind Schäden und auch da gab es Tote.
Nothing then to do, I ask, with raising his political profile.
Die Maßnahmen, die jetzt zu entscheiden waren.
The measures we had to decide are so important, a matter of life and death. You couldn't act on a tactical basis.
So dass man das nicht taktisch beantworten darf.
Das ist doch immer schön, dass man die Leute jetzt treffen kann.
Later, I sit opposite Katharina Resch in a tent in the garden of her care home. A Perspex screen divides us, but it means we can talk safely, face to face. The relaxation has meant her family has now been able to visit.
Ja, ich bin sehr skeptisch. Sehr skeptisch.
Even so, she says, I'm very skeptical, very skeptical. It's like tipping over a sack of potatoes. A care worker wheels Katharina back into the home and she waves goodbye. Staff here worry about the lifting of measures, that a second lockdown would be hard for the residents to bear. This country, praised worldwide for its initial success, feels rather fragile now.
Jenny Hill in Düsseldorf. 2 metres or one? It is a debate raging in the UK about how far apart we need to be to avoid catching coronavirus, with the economic benefits of allowing people to be closer together being weighed up against the health implications. Now, an analysis of social distancing published in the journal The Lancet has found the risk of transmission rises with every centimetre. Our health reporter Michelle Roberts has the details.
This is a pull together of the research that's out there, and it's important to say that the data that we have, some of it is looking at coronavirus, but a lot of it is looking at previous infections, so things like MERS and SARS. And the science is good, but it's not 100%. It can't give you the accuracy, the sort of black and white, will I get it if I do this, yes or no. But it does show that the further away you are, the lower the risk becomes. So if you approach people within a metre, then your risk might be around 13% of catching coronavirus. If you then maintain the 1 metre distance, that moves down to around 3%. But moving back to 2 metres makes it even lower, it halves it. So we're talking about 1 in 100. It certainly backs up the UK advice that 2 metres is a good distance to try and keep from other people, because we know that this virus can transmit by droplets.
Our health reporter, Michelle Roberts. Still to come in the podcast.
I think what we worry about is that, you know, we're going to get a deluge of patients over the coming weeks that we can't provide the care that they need.
Yemen under threat from coronavirus as the UN appeals for aid. An inquiry in Australia is looking at whether communication problems left people at increased risk from the deadly bushfires which raged last summer. With the new wildfire season just a couple of months away, the Royal Commission is investigating how to make Australia more resilient and safer in the face of natural disasters. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
For almost 8 weeks, the huge Green Valley fire menaced communities near the border of New South Wales and Victoria. It was ignited by lightning in late December. Firefighters were called in from across Australia, but many were using different radio frequencies and were often unable to contact each other. They say that in the heat of battle, the result was a dangerous lack of information. The Royal Commission into the Black Summer Blazes is investigating calls for an overhaul of the communications network. Mary Hoodless, a volunteer fire service safety officer, says a unified national system is needed.
For me, it's like, where's the common platform? The technology's there. Why haven't we got it? It's an issue on every occasion. There's a lot of border crossings with populations that have been highly impacted by that lack of communication. We can only hope, coming out of the Royal Commission, that we do see some improvement.
Emergency authorities in Australia say that liaison officers are deployed to enhance cooperation between crews from different jurisdictions. But the New South Wales Rural Fire Service concedes there is plenty of work to be done to permanently fix the problems. The Royal Commission is due to complete its work by the end of August.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. The UN has given a stark warning that three-quarters of major aid programs helping people in war-torn Yemen could close in the next few weeks unless billions of dollars can be raised. A pledging conference will get underway this afternoon, hosted by Saudi Arabia, which leads a military coalition fighting in Yemen. Lisa Grande is the UN coordinator.
The humanitarian operation is on the breaking point. The week before the first case of COVID was officially declared in Yemen, we had to stop incentives for 10,000 frontline health workers all across the country. These are people that we had been paying in lieu of their salaries for years. If we don't get the funding that we're asking for, this operation will break. It will break.
Disease and malnutrition is already rife in Yemen, and organisers of the conference say the health system there is at risk of being overwhelmed by the coronavirus. I spoke to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who has reported from Yemen many times.
The world may have forgotten that before this global pandemic, which has led everyone to believe that they are living in the world's worst humanitarian crisis, Yemen did have that terrible title, a country where 80% of the population relies on some form of aid in order to survive. That's the biggest percentage anywhere else in the world. And while everyone deals with this new pestilence, the coronavirus, the new virus, Yemen is still struggling to deal with cholera, malaria, diphtheria, dengue, chikungunya, and now COVID-19 is spreading there. And many fear it is spreading undetected, because another distinction Yemen now has, it has one of the world's lowest rates of testing. Look at the figures. Yemen, according to figures of the International Rescue Committee, tests 31 people per million, whereas Germany tests 43,000 people per million.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult given the devastated infrastructure in Yemen. I mean, what happens if it doesn't get this money?
Well, what the UN is saying, it's quite staggering. It is the world's biggest aid operation. And the head of UNICEF says they're even going to run out of soap, something so basic when wash your hands is now a global rallying cry. But it also means that the World Food Programme will have the rations that it gives to people in a country where 10 million are a step away from famine. And a week before the first COVID-19 case was declared, the United Nations stopped payments to 10,000 frontline medical workers across the country. You can't overestimate the impact of the world's biggest aid operation. Essentially, it says it's going to go broke in the next few weeks if it doesn't get money at today's pledging conference that's being co-hosted with Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, one of the main protagonists in this war.
Yeah, why is Saudi getting involved in that way?
Yes, many would say it would be an act of hypocrisy. The Saudi-led coalition unleashed this devastating war a little more than 5 years ago. But when this was first announced that there'd be this pledging conference, they were hoping there'd be peace talks by now.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. Health officials in Mozambique say there is growing discrimination against people suspected of being infected with COVID-19. There have been more than 250 confirmed cases in Mozambique. Here's our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
In some cases, the stigma has become so extreme that people are being threatened with violence. In the central city of Beira, those infected with the virus have been threatened with lynching. Health officials say this has led to a fall in the number of people going to clinics to report flu-like symptoms and other illnesses. Health workers have been sent into communities to try to convince people to seek medical help when needed. The hostility towards those suspected of having the virus has led the health ministry to restrict the amount of information it releases about the disease, including not disclosing locations where cases have been confirmed.
Mary Harper. Much of the music industry is on hold today in a show of solidarity following the death in police custody of the African-American man George Floyd. Artists, record labels and radio stations across the world are observing a day-long shutdown, as Chichi Azundu reports.
It's called Blackout Tuesday. Hundreds of record labels and artists around the world have cancelled their work plans for today to join in with their own protest. Yeah, I needed a change. Rapper Tiny Temper's label, Disturbing London, is also taking part. Dumio Barata is his manager and the CEO and says things need to change.
We got into that industry, you realise how whitewashed the industry really is, and it's not very reflective of what the real world looks like or who's really consuming the music or who's really contributing to making the music and making the industry tick, you know. So this is what's happening. This is not the world I want to be in. And I'm going to try to make a contribution to change.
Racism is happening all around us. So take a stand. If you are white and you're listening to this right now, this is your problem too. It's mine. It's yours. It's everybody's. It's uncomfortable to listen to, but we should feel uncomfortable about it.
The words of Radio 1's Breakfast Show presenter yesterday. But today, a number of BBC radio stations are also marking the event. Whilst the music industry goes quiet in protest, the sound of those taking to the streets in the UK is expected to rise.
Chichi Azundu. Finally, the Nigerian reggae star Majek Fashek has died at the age of 57. In a career spanning four decades, he worked with major international stars, including Jimmy Cliff, Tracy Chapman and Snoop Dogg. Richard Hamilton reports. The sky looked misty and cloudy. It looks like the rain gonna fall today.
Majek Fashek singing one of his most famous songs, Send Down the Rain. He was drawn to reggae in the 1980s, at a point when highlife and juju were the more dominant musical genres in Nigeria. Fashek acknowledged Bob Marley as a major influence, and the Nigerian's musical style and looks mirrored those of the Jamaican legend. His 1991 release, So Long for Too Long, which carried a strong political message for Africans to rise up, gained him widespread acclaim across the continent. He also wrote the song Free Africa, Free Mandela. In the mid-2000s, there were reports that he was struggling with ill health, and fans were shocked by pictures that emerged of an emaciated-looking Fashek. In 2015, he was admitted to a drug rehabilitation centre in the capital Abuja. His manager, Omenka Ozoma, said the reggae star died in his sleep in New York. The cause of his death has not been confirmed. In an Instagram message, Ozoma said the star had done so much for Nigeria and for Africa, adding it was a time for us all to celebrate his achievements and not to mourn.
Richard Hamilton on the life of Majek Fashek. And that is all from us for now. There'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.